Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, we talk about the books Things I've Learned from the Homeless, Privacy's Defender, Adult Braces, The Superman Wars, and we talk to CEO Damon John about AI small business growth.
Let's talk to Glenn Dunzweiler. He's a filmmaker, producer, writer, and public speaker. Let's add author to the list. Things I've Learned from the Homeless looks to explain the world that housed individuals are often frustrated by, the goal to flip viewpoints on homelessness. Let's get more from you. Glenn, a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing fine. Thank you. Talking to you across this wonderful U.S. of A. California, the L.A. area, your home, my friend?
Yes. Originally from Sacramento, but I've been in Los Angeles since 2015.
Tell us a little bit more about your career. Have you been bitten by the film and producer world?
In 2006, I bought a house. In 2008, we hit the housing crisis, and I saw a lot of people going homeless, and I, too, was in jeopardy of losing my house. And so I started this road of research to how people could become homeless and who those homeless people are. And that led me to making my first documentary, Why Homeless, on Amazon Prime. And once I figured out how people got homeless, I realized that it wasn't getting any better. We weren't solving problems. So that led me to a path of this social entrepreneurship, trying to figure out how I could change hearts and minds and dialogues to actually make a difference and get people off of the street, get people back into housing, back into society. So my first book, Things I've Learned from the Homeless, was kind of an addendum to the film I made, answering questions that people had after they watched the movie. Like my uncle would say, well, why can't a homeless guy just get a lawnmower and mow lawns? And I kind of went through the logistics of that. Then my second book was trying to get entrepreneurial skills to students, because I noticed we were setting them up to fail. We were strapping them with debt and with a degree that maybe didn't earn them enough money to pay off the degree and also live. And that's a degree in homelessness, entrepreneurial skills for students. And then this third book is The Moralists. I've seen for the last 10 years, we have really pushed housing first and harm reduction. And those two programs really have taken a lot of money, public money, and the public has not seen a lot of results. We've seen a lot of people that still cannot or will not play the get a job to pay rent game. And what I see is my fear is a return to insane asylums and internment camps, because the public is just frustrated. So my latest book, The Moralists, is a fiction. It's a novel, and it really says, okay, well, what if there were a group of people that just started answering questions, that started making decisions about people's lives and forcing them, or figuring out, encouraging them and forcing them to become productive members of society again. Because I wanted to play out these hopes and dreams that the public have about, and frustrations about, all the people they see, the drug addicts and the mentally ill and the people that we've just been ignoring for 15, 20 years. What happens when we actually try to do something? And we run into problems, because the utopian dream of the socialism helping people, in order to do that, you have to start kidnapping people. So it gets really fascist really quick.
Oh, thank you for that. Yes, much passion in your writing and documentary, documenting the homeless. Let me ask, you invite us to get into it with you, figuring this out, asking the questions such as, what, do the homeless anger you, frustrate you, scare you, and more?
Yes. Yeah. That is the thing that I've noticed is people are afraid to address uncomfortable things. And a lot of the world of homelessness is, it makes people uncomfortable, you know, life decisions, life circumstances, and people really are not willing to dig in to the situations because they've got their own lives and other people's bad decisions really ultimately don't matter to them. So what I try to do is force those bad decisions to become apparent and really try and give solutions to people that they don't really have to think through, and hopefully they can just be maybe inspired by, maybe touched by. My big thing is it's a community situation, and you need to do the best you can for the people in front of you right now, and you do whatever you can, but doing nothing just leads us to a bigger problem. So do something, whatever you can, to help.
Glenn Dunzweil with us again. Weiler, a filmmaker, producer, writer, public speaker. Of course, Why Homeless, the documentary, Things I Learned from the Homeless, and more. What's the name then of your latest work you mentioned?
It's called The Moralists. So it's, again, a novel. And I thought it was a good name to, because we're always talking about morals in this society. And the question I always have is, well, whose morals? When, where, and why? Who gets to make the decision? In other countries, in religious countries, they have people called the moral police. And I just thought, well, what if the United States had a moral police that was secular based? And then I had come up with what were the moralist guidelines, the tenets to moralism, and had this secular community follow it, but then they become maybe guardian angels, they become maybe a cult, they become maybe the CIA. Like, who are these people that are just, that are not in authority situations, making decisions about people's lives and encouraging people to live better lives?
So after this read in novel form, including your Things I've Learned from the Homeless and a degree in homelessness question, will and should there be action items for us? This is a challenge here, even in West Michigan.
Yeah, the especially about homelessness, I've narrowed it down to two things. One, that we have a serious degradation in family and community. Our socialism in the United States is family and community, just helping us solve problems. I need to move from this place to this place. Okay, I'll help you. I have a van. I have a truck that doesn't cost you any money. If you don't have that, or if you don't have an aunt that you can stay with when your house burns down or whatever may happen, we don't have a community solution other than family. Everything else is a capitalist solution, and that gets very expensive. So the degradation of family and community has really hurt us. Plus, we're investing ourselves out of shelter. We look at housing as an investment opportunity. And the problem is people need some place to stay. So we're kind of leaving a class of people behind who can no longer afford the rent for the investment opportunity of the owner. And those two things are really forcing people out. So I would love for people to return to a more robust family and community, helping your neighbor, that whole thing that I was taught in the 70s and 80s, and I'm sure it was taught earlier. That's kind of gone away. And then also figuring out, we have to figure out some kind of housing that is obviously more than family and community. There has to be, whether if we go back to government housing, but I know we've had problems with that, you know, Cabrini Green in Chicago, these big housing complexes that lost upkeep money and then turned into just these violent places. So we don't want to return to that. But we have to come up with some kind of solution to house people when they don't have enough money to afford the luxury apartment.
Yes, thank you for that. Glenn, good work you do, and we appreciate that. Tell us how we find out more about your latest and what you have for us, please.
Yeah. You can always go to my website, glenndunsweiler.com, and I am apparently the only Glenn Dunsweiler in the world. At least Google says that. So if you can spell my name, you can find me. It's Glenn with one N, Dunsweiler, DUNZWEILER.com. And The Moralists has its own website. So if you go to themoralists.com, you can find my book.
Thanks for your time. Take care of Cali for us, and certainly continue your good work in this niche. Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you so much.
Electronic Frontier Foundation Executive Director also wears an author hat. Cindy Cohen on the lines. Pronounced C-O-H-N. A memoir out. Privacy's Defender, My 30-Year Fight Against Digital Surveillance. Let's dig into the weeds. I'm glad you're here. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
First of all, tell me about your day job, Electronic Frontier Foundation, yes?
Yes, we are the oldest and largest digital civil liberties organization in the world. We were founded before the World Wide Web, and our job is to make sure that when you go online, your rights go with you.
Hence a tease for our conversation. Your work is described as a compelling account of a life well lived and an inspiring call to action for the next generation of civil liberties, liberties champions. We'll get into this. Tell me a little bit about your book and the premise.
Yeah, I mean, the book is really my life. It's a professional memoir. But I tell three sets of stories in it about the fights that I've led in order to try to protect privacy online. And, you know, my hope is both to kind of help people see how we've gotten the privacy that we have online, which is still not sufficient, but is more than we would have had if it hadn't been for the fights, but also to show where we still need to go in order to have, you know, a pretty simple idea that we deserve to have the right to have a private conversation in the digital world. And, you know, there's so many ways in which we're being tracked and monitored and the information is being gathered and collated now, and with the increased use of AI really being marshaled in ways that, you know, can really feel disempowering. And I'm hoping to both kind of show that, but also really show us a way forward, hopefully inspire some people to think that this is a fight that they can do and they can get into and help make the world better for everybody.
Cindy, have you spent your whole career challenging the politicians and corporations that relentlessly try to, I'll say, peer into our daily lives right up through lawsuits and more?
Yeah, I mean, probably it's turned out to be. It's true. You know, 30 years is a long time. And, you know, I didn't start out thinking that this was what I was going to do. But, you know, I got lucky and met some of the early people who were on the internet before, you know, kind of ordinary people really were. And they identified this problem as something we were going to have to solve. And they asked me to help them. And it really did suck me in, because I think it's important. I think privacy is one of the foundational things that help us do all sorts of other things, you know, from navigating the world and getting information, you know, securely and with trust, all the way up to, you know, organizing for democracy, you know, that we have a secret vote in this country for a reason. Having a little zone of privacy around us gives us freedom.
Cindy, would you share a little bit? I know you weave your own personal story, history of crypto wars, FBI gang orders, post 9/11 surveillance state. Would you share an example, a story?
Well, let me see. The crypto story starts with a call that I got from one of these early internet guys. His name was John Gilmore, and he told me that there was a, you know, PhD math student who wanted to publish his computer code on the internet. And I said, well, but if he did, he would go to jail as an arms dealer. And I said, well, what does it do? Does it blow things up? And he said, no, it keeps things secret. And I said, well, that sounds wrong. And he said, I think it's wrong, too. And so we put together a First Amendment challenge to that case. The case was called Bernstein versus Department of Justice. And ultimately, we succeeded. And this is why people have some of the basic security that they have now, whether you're using an app called Signal or whether you're just navigating to your bank. And you know, you see the little, you know, there's a little security thing that happens. That's because there's something happening on the back end that uses encryption to free it up. So, you know, that was kind of my first case that sucked me in. And I try to go back and forth between kind of, you know, kind of telling how it was to live through it, not just kind of explaining why privacy is important, like the way a journalist might or an academic might, but really as a practitioner, as somebody who really lived it. And along the way, a lot of interesting things happened to me. You know, I discovered I was adopted. I discovered my birth family through my work. I ultimately met my husband through my work, and lots of other things along the way. And I kind of told it personally because I think that's a way that people can think about doing this work that maybe makes it feel a little more doable for folks.
Yes, plus you're spearheading a team of more than 120 lawyers, activists, technologists dedicated to ensuring that tech supports speech and more. Speaking with Cindy Cohen, privacy's defender, my 30-year fight against digital surveillance. Surveillance. What else is important here? Share one more story, Cindy.
Sure. I think another story that might be something people don't know is that a few years into doing some of this privacy work, I got a call from a little phone company, and I had given a presentation at their offices about voting machines. And I said, well, if anything weird happens with the FBI, why don't you call me? And they called me, and they had gotten served with information demanding that they turn over information about one of their customers and that they never tell anyone about it ever. It had an eternal gag order. And this is something called a national security letter that really got supercharged after the Patriot Act and was used hundreds of thousands of times by the government to demand information about people from their ISPs, from their phone companies, from other companies, and gagged the company from ever telling anyone this had happened. And we undertook this case on behalf of that company, and another company joined us. And we were unable to tell anybody the names of our clients for over 6 years. We had to do this in absolute secrecy. And ultimately, the judge agreed with us that, you know, the government can gag companies for a little while so they can do their investigations, but they can't gag them forever. And use of these gags had really sheltered this program from any public or governmental oversight. And once we revealed how often the government was really using this tool in situations that involved, again, way more people than you would need for, you know, kind of the narrow focused investigations that are legitimate against potential terrorists, Congress reined it in and said, you know, you can't have these eternal gags, and you need to use these tools separately. So we really, you know, by having to, you know, keep quiet, we called the cases, you know, the alphabet cases. One was case X, one was case Z, one was case Y. We had to do this in secret for 6 years, but ultimately we were able to get to a place where we could tell the public and members of Congress what was going on. And Congress said, this is too much, you're misusing this. And we were able to carve it back a little bit. And I tell this story because I think it's important to think about how we do this, how you actually do this work to try to, you know, bring some accountability. You know, I think, you know, we want our law enforcement and our national security forces to have really strong powers, but we also need accountability. We need ways to make sure that they're not overusing them or misusing them. And this process it's really important. It's how we have balance because, you know, it's our rights, it's our privacy that's in the mix.
Your work described as a rallying cry for hope in our troubled times, described as beautifully written stories on the whys for the fight for privacy. Cindy Cohen, how do we find out more about your work, Privacy's Defender?
EFF.org, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org/Privacy's Defender. There's information there. I'll be coming on a little book tour. I think I'm coming to Michigan as part of that.
Yay.
I went to University of Michigan. So I'm from Iowa. So I'm a Midwest girl at heart. I'm very excited to get to come come, you know, home in many ways and talk about this work. But at EFF.org/privacy's defender has more about the book, where you can buy it, the audio book, and where I'm going to be on my little tour.
Yes, back to Michigan, you must come. Privacy's Defender, my 30-year fight against digital surveillance. Thanks you very much to you, Cindy Cohen.
Thank you.
Is entitled Adult Braces, Driving Myself Sane. In New York Times bestselling author Lindy West's ambitious memoir, she brings us along an uproarious cross-country road trip, unpacking your last few tumultuous years, rediscovering yourself, reinventing your marriage in the process. That's a lot in your unique front cover book. Lindy, good morning to you. Glad you're here.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
All right, here we are. You are sharing the story of your rock bottom and the journey you took to claw out of it. That's called A Memoir and More. Congratulations, not your first go-around, author of at least three books and more. And I know executive and writer executive producer Shrill, the Hulu comedy, and more. So living in the beautiful Washington State, thanks for getting up early.
Oh, well, I'm actually on my way to New York for the tour to start, and so I am in Nebraska.
All right, well, that's just an hour or so. time change. I digress. Lindy West, congratulations. Adult Braces. What? Let's even start with Adult Braces, if you would.
Yeah, so in 2020, I went to the dentist, and I had always had perfect teeth, according to my dentist. And then suddenly I go to the dentist and she says that my teeth are misaligned, cracking, and falling apart. And so suddenly in my late 30s, I had to get braces. And it was an exercise in sort of letting go of a little bit of control, I think, and just letting myself... you know, I didn't get Invisalign. I got classic metal braces because I didn't trust myself to not take the trays out and throw them away. And and so, you know, I had braces for a couple of years, realigned my teeth, all's well. But, you know, the more I thought about it, the more it felt like kind of an apt metaphor for the hard work of life and sort of self-discovery and improvement. And so when I started thinking about my next memoir, I was like, man, you know what I really did was I kind of put braces on my life. Mm. And then I very slowly let them do their work. And I mean, well, no, I did the work, but, you know, the yeah. braces imperceptibly move your teeth around while you're going about your business. And I found that there were a lot of things that I needed to correct that we're going to take a really long, you know, slow time to happen.
Yes. Your book, Shrill, and then, of course, the Hulu series. I'm reading that you are certainly an inspiration being stopped on the street. But I'm also seeing that behind the scenes, what, you never felt like you were the self-actualized woman the fans made out you to be? Tell us more about you.
Yeah. You know, I think it's an interesting career path to, you know, have your job be kind of processing and digesting your own life in front of other people. And so, you know, I wrote Shrill when I was in my early 30s, I think. And, you know, I was really writing about who I was in my 20s and about some epiphanies that I'd had in my 20s about my body and about my life and what I wanted and what I deserved. And, specifically, you know, rejecting the idea that fat people aren't allowed to be happy until they lose weight. And, you know, there's a lot of people who really needed to hear that. I was one of those people, you know, that kind of messaging really saved me in my 20s. And so once I became a spokesperson for those ideas, I discovered much later that it didn't leave me room for, you know, complicated feelings. I had sort of declared myself healed and wise, and then all of a sudden I didn't feel that way anymore, and I had a lot more work to do, but I was in this bind where I had told everyone, oh yeah, I got this figured out. And so that's what a lot of this book is about kind of re-examining those assumptions and those, you know, vectors of growth and things that I didn't lie about them. I thought that I had them figured out, but I really didn't. And that's kind of the harder work that you do maybe later. You know, if Shrill was about, was me in my 30s writing about my 20s, this book is me in my 40s writing about my 30s.
Did you, at what point were you in what's described as the throes of a deep depression, your marriage and sense of self-worth hanging in the balance where you knew you needed to make a change? Was that a 20 or 30 thing?
That was a 30s thing. Mm. You know, I think in my 20s, I was like, yeah, I don't have depression. I'm just like kind of, yeah. I don't know, just figuring it out. You don't, I remember not feeling like I had much of a sense of who, you know, what my brain was doing. I remember declaring to people like, oh, I don't have any, I'm really lucky that I don't have any mental health challenges. And then, but meanwhile, it's like, yeah, but sometimes you can't, you know, get out of bed for days and you like it feels physically impossible to like do your laundry. That's not normal. And you don't have to live like that. You don't have to live your life just pushing through that kind of inertia and feeling like not just like, oh, I don't want to do these chores or I don't want to go socialize and see people, but that it's like physically impossible. That's actually not normal. And so, but I didn't really start figuring that out until, I don't know, 2019, 2020, when I was 38. So
yeah, when you got your braces. Tell us about this road trip. You write about the eye-opening natural wonders, obviously the front cover sharing some beautiful scenery and some what kitschy roadside attractions. Give me a story.
Yeah, so in 2021, my husband and I had gone through a couple years of couple therapy. We were like really figuring out a lot of conflicts that had been simmering and suppressed for a long time. And all of a sudden we were doing a lot better. But I think once I started excavating some of my depression and some of my bad, you know, dysfunctional patterns and really spending more time with myself and getting to know myself, all of a sudden I was feeling stifled at home and I was like, I got to get out of here. And I think a lot of that was COVID too. I just wanted to know what it felt like to have nobody need anything from me for an extended period of time, like a month. And so I rented a van and I've never done anything like this before. I rented a van, a camper van, and I drove from Seattle to Key West, Florida and back all by myself. And I slept in the van and I just wanted to go out and see what I could find. And, you know, really for years and years, I hadn't wanted to do anything without my husband, who's my best friend. And I thought that was normal. And it is normal, but it's also normal to want some time to yourself, and it's good and it's healthy. And so, yeah, so I hit the road and I was gone for a month, and it was really transformative. It was really hard and scary and also easy and fun. It was kind of everything all in one. And now I'm doing the book tour also as a road trip in a van, which is why I'm in Nebraska.
There we are. It doesn't stop. Adult braces. Driving Myself Sane by you, Lindy West. What's your take-home message?
Just to be brave and to move toward the scary things, because that's where the best version of your life is. Nothing good lies beyond sort of cowering and being in a cocoon. Go out and do stuff. Follow your instincts and be curious and be brave.
How do we find out more about adult braces?
You can go to adultbracesbook.com.
As easy as that. Yep.
Any bookstore.
Safe driving and, of course, continued journeys to you, Lindy. You only go around once, and looks like you've got it awesome. Thanks for the work you do. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Well, I'm a fan of Superman. It's even on my running playlist, that Superman theme. And my next guest, most likely as well, spinning it in a unique way. The Superman Wars, written by William Bernhardt, a battle for truth, justice, and an American icon. So we speak with you. You are a national best-selling author yourself. William, we'll call you Bill. Good morning to you.
Thanks. Good morning to you, too. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome. Do you have an interest in Superman?
Oh, I've got a lifelong interest in Superman ever since I was a kid. And like you were saying, who doesn't love Superman? He's become a global symbol of hope.
And yet you turn this into a unique opportunity. For generations, we know Superman has stood as a symbol of hope, morality, and idealism. Yet, are you sharing a bit of the true story? Talk to us more, William.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about Jerry Siegel. That's who the book is about, the writer who came up with the idea for Superman when he was 11th grader in the middle of Cleveland during the Depression, and ran and got his pal Joe Shuster to draw it, and spent years marketing, creating, and promoting this character who, as you know, stands for truth, justice, and the American way. Unfortunately, his creators got none of the above. In too soon a time, they found themselves fired, their names stripped from the Superman feature, and, you know, really struggling to get by, while meanwhile, Superman was making millions and millions every year.
Let's dig a little bit more into your research. We're talking Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, yes, whose work helped define this industry, but your background as a lawyer gives you this unique lens. So talk to me a little bit more about, their work.
Well, their work was, of course, creating and writing and drawing Superman. But as I just indicated, that didn't turn out so well for them. There was about 70 years of litigation, which is what first drew me into this project, because I knew a little bit about it, but I never understood, you know, what took so long? Why does it take 70 years to resolve anything? And what's with all the appeals and the back and forth? And I couldn't really find a good explanation of that. But I thought, as you alluded to my legal background, maybe I can, you know, I understand that for people who haven't been through law school, understanding all the motions and pleadings and, you know, appeal, and it's back in the trial court, and you're like, what's going on? I thought I could maybe straighten that out. But I don't want people to get the idea that this book is just about lawsuits, because that would be boring, and who wants that? You know, when you understand the people involved, everything makes more sense. So I wrote this in sort of a narrative nonfiction viewpoint from Jerry's standpoint, so that people would understand not just what happened, but why.
Well, let's talk about the whys.
Well, I mean, the why is because Jerry made a tragic mistake when he was still very young. Jerry had lost his father when he was 17. He was living, it was a poor family. And his father was gone. He had no lawyer. He had no agent, no one to advise him. Joe's father was an elevator operator at a local hospital. They were on their own, you know, and as a result, eventually, they signed something they shouldn't have signed. Jerry spent years trying to get this Superman feature presented as a newspaper strip, because that was the big deal in the middle of the Depression. Everybody wanted a newspaper strip. Everybody read them. They were very popular and could be profitable for creators. And he tried for years but couldn't get a strip. So eventually he took a look at this new area called the comic book, which didn't launch till 1935, and was, you know, was kind of the unwanted stepchild of newspaper strips. It was scruffy and new, and that's where Superman was presented. Jerry created this whole genre of superheroes, which is, of course, today, almost 90 years later, still wildly popular. He gave life to this baby industry called the comic book, but found himself being completely cut out of the action. And, you know, it's just, he, in order to finally get it published, he had to sign a release that it wasn't even part of the main part, but of the agreement. But at the bottom, it said, you're surrendering all rights to the characters, and that's how he lost control of Superman, unfortunately.
William Bernhardt with us, Bill, an award-winning author of more than 60 books. His latest is out, The Superman Wars, A Battle for Truth, Justice, and the American Icon. And this speaks directly to modern creators. The book raises enduring questions I see about ownership, fairness, and balance between art and commerce, Bill?
Absolutely. I mean, I would love to tell you that this was a problem 100 years ago, but not anymore, but that's just not the way it is. This conflict between art and commerce is still with us. And sadly, it seems like commerce always wins, you know? And the artists end up getting the short end of the stick, and that is not the way it should be. If we want to have art, then we've got to support artists. I mean, what happened in the case of Jerry Siegel? You know, he was the most important writer with the most important creator in comic books. But if he could be screwed over, then anybody could. You know, what hope was there for anyone? And indeed, for decades, comic book creators, though their work was widely popular, rarely could even make a living wage because, you know, if they could do that to Superman's creators, they could do it to anyone. I think this book will appeal regardless of whether you're into comic books or superheroes or anything like that, because this is about how we as a society treat our artists. And whatever you think about Jerry's mistakes, signing things he shouldn't have, this business of taking their names off their own creation, even sometimes they would reprint old features that had appeared before but take their names off it first, I'm sorry, but that's just wrong. Whatever legalities might be involved, removing their names from the feature was morally and ethically wrong.
And lastly, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and today I think it would be illegal because the United States finally signed the Berne Convention in the 80s, didn't help Jerry any. And, that, among other clauses, it's designed to protect copyrights and whatnot internationally. And under the Berne Convention, taking somebody's name off their creation would just be illegal. It'd just be, violation of the agreement. But this was long ago. This was back in the 30s and 40s.
And lastly, the character does continue to evolve, would you say, Bill?
Oh, yeah. I think every time you bring a new writer to the feature, it's going to be a new take and reflect the person who's writing it. Interestingly, Jerry did come back and was able to write some more Superman stories in 59, although he didn't get his name on them and he wasn't paid any better than anybody else, but even anonymously, for 4 or 5 years, he's writing by far the best Superman stories that ever been written. I mean, by that time, he's an older and wiser Jerry who's seen some life, and he's writing stories that reflect that. In some cases, they're just heartbreaking. I mean, any time a 23-page comic book story can make you cry, that's a good writer, And yet still did not receive the recognition. I want to emphasize, though, that this, I'm making this sound so dire. This book does have something of a happy ending. If all anybody remembers about these guys is that they got a small pension in 75, that's just the beginning of where the worm turns. The story gets way more interesting after that. And that's what I cover in the book.
Nice. The book is The Superman Wars. How do we find out more information, William Bernhardt?
Well, more information about me, you can go to my website. It's williambernhardt.com or find me on Facebook. The book is available wherever you get books. I saw Amazon this morning, and it's got a number one flag, so
yay.
I guess some people are in. Yes, exactly. Yay. The Amazon is like a crack addiction for authors. You just keep reloading the page to see where your rank is.
Keep on writing and reminding us of Superman. The Superman Wars by you, William. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, how are businesses adapting to AI, and what does it mean for growth this year, 2026? Let's turn to the best, Shark Tank's Damon John on the line, entrepreneur, FUBU founder, teaming up with Intuit Enterprise Suite to, talk about this topic. Damon John, always a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. How are things in the tank these days?
Things in the tank are really great. Kevin O'Leary started to become more of a movie star. So if we are lucky, he is going to leave the tank to become a movie star, and then all the deals will be mine.
There you go. And, of course, the good work that you do. Remind me about FUBU, please.
You said remind you about it?
Yes, FUBU. What's that mean?
Well, that's Bias. It was a brand that I created in the late 80s, early 90s, where it was apparel that we were making for the hip-hop culture by kids who absolutely were obsessed with the hip-hop culture. But if you think about For Us Bias, I think every single business is a For Us Bias, right? It's a person who's a hairdresser who wants to make cool style that she likes for other people, or a bakery, right? But make stuff that they want to eat. So For Us Bias is, I call it the first acronym of clothing.
Yeah.
And then I went on to become an investor in Shark Tank.
Of course, global brand it is. Let's get into this conversation. Are businesses, or maybe better said, how are businesses adapting? Are we making that move to AI, Damon?
You know, small businesses are not doing it as fast as I believe they should, and I think that it's because they just don't know about their options out there. I think you see it in large enterprise businesses that are, you know, travel agencies, credit cards, rental cars and stuff like that, toll bridges, right? But I do believe that small businesses right now, they use AI kind of like, yeah, you know, I use ChatGPT like Google. I write a couple of, letters on it. And I think that today they don't realize how they can apply it, whether it's in their social media, why it's programming their social media and editing for the next month or 2 months, so all your social media is taken care of in, you know, 3 hours instead of, 2 weeks, or things like the Intuit Enterprise Suite, where the most important thing in business, and that's why you're in business, is money, to understand how you're using it. What are your margins? What is your sales? Where are you spending a lot of your time in the company? Are you deploying a lot of money towards things that are not bringing in a lot of money? And I think this is a critical tool that, Intuit Enterprise Suite has created that really can empower people and give them a dashboard instead of waiting every month or quarter to talk to your accountant where you got glossy eyes not knowing what he or she is telling you.
Yes, Intuit Enterprise Suite, breaking down what's changing and what businesses need to know. You have a whole playbook for businesses. We say time is the biggest challenge. What, too many hours spent on manual tasks instead of growth?
Absolutely. Most entrepreneurs, unless you are an accountant, open up a business to provide a value to or a service to other people. And a lot of times we get caught so busy working in the business, looking at numbers, dealing with manufacturing and stuff, and plugging things in here that we never wanted to do. I started a clothing brand because I just wanted to dress people and go to hip-hop concerts. The last thing I wanted to do was look at spreadsheets for 3 days about materials and various other things. So things like, Intuit Enterprise Suite take those things off the table because they give you a real-time dashboard of everything happening in your company. More importantly, if you've got more people in your company, it can give them division heads, partners, and stuff like that, and you go, listen, I know you want to do all this, but are we up 5%? Are we losing 20%? Just look at your dashboard and tell us what we can do. You can do anything else you want to do, but let's take care of the numbers and the business first. And it gives you a report card.
Nice. Never too old or too young for report cards. Shark Tank's Damon John with us, also FUBU founder, wonderful clothing brand, has been graced his presence, your presence here in Grand Rapids way back when. Let's talk, Damon, with a couple minutes left about simplification. Simplification is a competitive edge. Expand here.
Yes, simplification is. You know, when we look at things like finance tools, you know, as I earlier shared, whether you're looking at whether it's margins or sales or returns or paying the rent or employees, you need to be able to look at a very easy pie chart / dashboard on what's going on. I mean, think about it. When you get in your car and drive, 100 miles without knowing how much gas you have, if the air and the tires are accurate, if the check light comes on, how about oil and things of that nature, do the brakes work? Well, don't you just get in there and you look at your dashboard? Would you get in your car these days without a dashboard at all to know what you have to get you from destination A from destination B? It's simplicity on a dashboard. And that's why I look at things like Intuit Enterprise Suite. It's giving you all the tools you need there so you can concentrate on the things that are really difficult. How do I change my business where I'm changing with today's economy or fashion or taste or stuff like that, or finding new customers? And that's what, you know, entrepreneurs need to understand. Taking the paper cuts off your desk frees up time for you to do what you do best.
Yep, no dashboard, probably would speed. Damon John, take-home message, if one business owner is ready to step up his or her game in the world of AI, what's your suggestion?
Bottom line is whether it's AI or anything else, stepping up as a business owner is almost is critical, and here's how you do it. There's only two ways to operate a business. You either increase sales or you reduce costs. The only way you can do that is by knowing your numbers. As you've seen on Shark Tank for the last 17 years, what do we ask people? Most of the pitch is, do you know your numbers? So if you have a powerful tool like Intuit Enterprise Suite that is not only giving you your data, but it can go out to the world and check the data on your competitors and or various things in your industry, well, then now you know if you're on the right path. Because at the end of the day, you're in business to make money, to feed your family, to make sure that you can supply and provide for your customer, to make sure you can supply and provide for your staff. So it's about your numbers first. If you're going to go into AI, know your numbers, and Intuit Enterprise Suite is exactly the brand and or the technology that can help you.
So what's the best resource for us? Where do we go for more information?
All right, you go to intuit.com/enterprise.
Thank you for your time. Again, you have graced your presence in Grand Rapids, investing in our local company, SheFit, and doing the things you do now. Damon John, thank you.
Thank you.